Hello, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, August the 14th. We will talk about the subprime mortgage meltdown once again this hour, in part because some listeners requested this issue in my open line earlier this month, and because of the continued jitters in the stock market and Democratic presidential candidates last week seizing on the issue, offering new proposals to help solve the crisis, like Senator Clinton's idea for a $1 billion fund to help homeowners avoid foreclosure. President Bush disagreed with that approach when asked last week, calling instead for enforcement of laws already on the books and letting the market work. What's the cause? What's the effect of this subprime mortgage problem? What's the solution? We'll ask our guest economist, and we will welcome your questions for him. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Senator Clinton isn't the only one getting in on the act. A number of the Democratic presidential candidates are speaking out on the mortgage crisis. Senator Clinton proposing the $1 billion fund to help families avoid foreclosure. Former Senator John Edwards calling for banning some practices, lending practices like balloon loans, where interest rates will grow dramatically over time. Senator Barack Obama introduced a bill that would impose new penalties on mortgage professionals found guilty of fraud and predatory lending. Why are the Democrats seizing upon this issue, and what is the response of the administration? We'll talk about that as well. Our guest is Kevin Quinn, Associate Professor of Economics at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks again for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's just start. What is the subprime mortgage problem, and is it going too far to call this a crisis?
Well, let me perhaps start by talking about what a subprime mortgage is.
Okay.
There might be some folks that aren't quite clear about that. You know, there's an old joke that banks will only lend money to people who don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
And that would sort of constitute the prime mortgage market, the people that have very good credit histories, people that put 20% down or more maybe, people that can verify their income, that sort of thing. And that particular market, the mortgage market, the prime mortgage market, had a lot to do with a large rise in home ownership during the 20th century. However, there are a lot of people that don't have ideal credit and can't verify their mortgages or their income and that sort of thing. And in recent years, with the last, you know, 7, 8, 9 years, a market has emerged to lend those people money. And like everything else in finance, there's a trade-off between risk and return. If you're a higher credit risk, you're probably going to pay a little bit more, you know, to rent the money to account for the fact that a higher percentage of those people won't pay it back or they'll be late with it, et cetera. And that particular innovation was welcomed by regulators, by all sorts of folks, because it opened up the opportunity for home ownership for people that had otherwise been shut out. The problem is, in the last few years, it seems that that particular market has gone hog wild. Just like other kinds of bubbles, people start to think that that the old rules are all gone and everything's changed. Whenever you hear anybody say that, get scared.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, and some financial innovations, it's been possible to make some money off of this. Well, the problem is that there's been some predatory practices. The ability to spread the risk around has been a little bit too easy, and so now we have a large percentage of outstanding mortgages that people have no shot at paying back.
Yeah, so a lot of people are losing their homes.
Yes, foreclosure rates are up dramatically, and in some places they're really high, like, you know, 1930s high.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that, you know, if you live in a nice neighborhood, one house is foreclosed upon, it doesn't really spread. But a lot of these loans were concentrated among a particular, you know, demographic of income and race. And as a result of that, those folks are living in the same neighborhood. There are lots of these foreclosed homes, which is depressing the housing prices in the neighborhood and just sort of cascades and creates all kinds of problems when you have abandoned homes.
Well, what do you think of Senator Clinton's idea for this $1 billion fund to help homeowners avoid foreclosure?
Well, it's an interesting idea. $1 billion is a lot of money unless you compare it to the $11 trillion of outstanding mortgage debt. So you're talking about an amount of money that's equal to 1/10,000th of the amount of mortgage debt, you know, residential mortgage debt out there, which means that it would have to be somehow leveraged in the best possible way. So I'm guessing that what she would suggest, I haven't seen specific details of this, but I'm guessing that it would be a fund that people could sort of help catch them up on their mortgage payments. However, given the magnitude of the problem, I suspect that it wouldn't be enough to really solve the problem.
Yeah. Whereas President Bush, when asked about that, said no, he didn't like that the bailout idea, but said that there should be enforcement of laws already on the books and transparency for people getting mortgages, but just let the market work.
Yes, and I think what you're seeing, as much as anything else, are two divergent philosophies about this. On one hand, and I'll attribute to this to the Republicans, there's the philosophy of personal responsibility. Read what you're signing, and you're responsible for the obligations you take on. On the other side are people that say that there are people that have been preyed upon by unscrupulous lenders, that they should be punished, and since regulators were asleep at the switch, it is the responsibility of the government to help people out.
Yeah. Let's check the weather, see if any more rain is in the forecast. Quite a stormy night overnight. And then we'll continue talking with Kevin Quinn, Associate Professor of Economics at St. Norbert College in De Pere, talking about the subprime loan crisis and what Democratic presidential candidates are proposing to do about it. And welcming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, August the 14th. Stay with us. Coming up later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, Ben will talk with a contractor combatant who has a unique perspective on what's happening in Iraq right now, how it's changed, and what the future holds. He is the author of the book, Contractor Combatants, after 5 o'clock. We're talking about the subprime mortgage meltdown with Kevin Quinn, Associate Professor of Economics at St. Norbert College in De Pere, and welcoming your questions for him. Our lines have filled up quickly on this, so let's go to the phones and take our first caller, Kay in Milwaukee. Hi, Kay, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Just a comment and a quick question. When I bought my house in the year 2000, it wasn't in the subprime market, but I wonder if some of those practices were bleeding over into the prime market. The amount of money that the bank was willing to lend me was outrageous. I knew I could never afford a mortgage that high, so I gave myself a lower limit, and I did have an adjustable rate, and when it went up $100, I was able to handle it because I hadn't maxed myself out. I mean, they were willing to loan me, I think it was half or more than half of my take-home pay. And you don't pay that much for your mortgage. I mean, isn't it? And my question would be, isn't that part of being a responsible grown-up to know what you can afford?
Yes, it is part of being a responsible grown-up. But I think if you were to look at the various obligations that American consumers have taken on, the responsible grown-up seems to be a dying species. The other thing is that here in Wisconsin, with the exception, I think, of parts of Milwaukee, the subprime problem has not visited us nearly as much as it has in other markets where housing prices exploded to the extent that they did. I think that, you know, in a period of rising housing values, banks are much more willing to take on risk, figuring that, well, you know, if they don't pay it, we foreclose upon it, and we're going to sell it, and we're going to make all of our money back. So they're willing to be a little bit riskier. And if you look across the country, we're looking in 04 and 05 at double-digit housing value appreciation. Well, you know, anything that can't go on forever won't, but people in that industry forgot about it. Individuals forgot about it. They just sort of thought that, hey, this is going to go on forever. We didn't see that here in Wisconsin. We saw, on average, something on the order of, 6% thereabouts. Now, that varied tremendously by area. So we didn't quite get as caught up in that as some of the other states did.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, Professor Quinn, is Senator Clinton and other Democrats are calling for the expansion of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but that's something that the president and the administration, anyway, is also skeptical about. Why? What's that all about?
Well, this has sort of been an ongoing battle between the Republicans and the Democrats. Basically, it's because these two agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, compete with private markets, and they have a bit of an advantage because they have government guarantees for the bonds that they have. When you get a mortgage, it's unusual anymore for the bank that you get the mortgage with in the old savings and loans days to actually hang on to that and make money off of that. What happens is those are sold in a secondary market. They're securitized. So what they do is they bundle hundreds of mortgages together and they sell a bond that is backed by the mortgages that are being paid. And so it sort of homogenizes that. The advantage of the bonds of those two organizations is that they're apparently guaranteed by the government. The Republicans count bankers more in their ranks than the Democrats do, and these markets have private and sort of these quasi-public entities in there, and the Republicans are on one side, the Democrats are on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Next we go to Joe in Neillsville. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hello. My question was kind of addressed, but I was wondering, what is the influence of the increasing home prices? I just recently purchased a home in the Madison area, and it just amazed me at the home values tripled to the homes where I grew up and tripled the price of the homes in Green Bay where I'd gone to school. And what is the influence on this, and is some of the blame on an overinflated housing value market out there?
I think that's true. Whether or not that's overinflated, I hard to say, but it certainly has increased rapidly. Warren Buffett, the financier, has a phrase where you don't find out who's swimming naked until the tide rolls out, which is really apropos here, because as long as the asset is going up in price, it seems not very risky. If you take too much of an obligation, you figure, well, I can always sell it. Or, when my mortgage resets, some of these mortgages were the 2.28 mortgages where you got a low teaser rate, and then 2 years later it went way up. You figure, well, I can refinance because, I'll have some equity in there. If you're counting on double-digit asset price increase, that's fine. Even if you get foreclosed, before you get foreclosed upon, in a nice market, you can sell off and, you'll get financially spanked, but not quite the same thing as having the bank take your house. Well, it looks like those days are over and the chickens are coming home to roost. Mm.
Now, I just saw on the wire, I don't know, it was yesterday or the day before, about the Fed was saying that mortgage lenders were really tightening their practices now, not only with the subprime market, but with my market.
Right. Well, there's a couple of different things that are going on. I think, first of all, everyone, after indulging from Thanksgiving until New Year's Day in January, promises they're going to lose weight and, gets religion. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an element of that. But there's more to it than that. It takes two to make a baby. It's not enough just to have people who are willing to sign obligations that they have no chance of paying back. You need people who are willing to give them that money. And we have had several years of innovation where we have a bunch of complex, very complex financial instruments, which in effect can sort of bury the apparent risk. you know, it's a little bit too much to say that it's sort of laundering the risk, but there is some of that. And what was happening was a lot of these very risky bonds that were being backed by these subprime loans were finding themselves in highly rated, low-risk equities. Well, it may be that the risk was understated, but it wasn't at all transparent. And these, you know, when you own a bond, that's an asset. And these various banks and financial companies were sort of using these things as collateral for other loans, and it seemed like the risk was going away. Well, the risk is there. And what's happening is some of the it's thrown sand in the gears of the lending market and has reduced liquidity. And that's the big concern, is that, you know, are we going to, wind up having credit crunch for breakfast? And to some extent, that has been the case. The central banks in Europe and in the U.S. have been keenly aware of this, and they're trying to, you know, throw more liquidity into the system so that the thing doesn't come to a halt.
Next, we go to Beth in Burlington. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Couple of things. I just wanted to comment that I really appreciate some of the federal programs out there to subsidize first-time home buyers. My husband and I, we did purchase our first home by FHA, and then a few years later did an FHA streamline to get a better interest rate. But I think there's just been a lot of irresponsibility out there by both buyers and mortgage lenders. In my family, there's two particular families that I know one is going to be losing their home. And in neither family, neither one of them should have been allowed to get a mortgage because of their practices, their spending practices. They had a hard time paying their rent in years past. And I'm just wondering how people like that, who have a hard time paying their rent, get mortgages.
Well, that's sort of right there at the crux of the problem. The Center for Responsible Lending, which is an organization that studies this, and they're pretty reasonable. They claim that the people that get FHA loans and the people that have been getting subprime loans sort of look the same credit-wise, or they're from the same demographics, and yet the FHA loans seem to have half the default rate of the subprime loans. A lot of this business has been generated by brokers. You can have a broker that's just sitting at her kitchen table trying to sell people on the idea that they get to get loans, because what they do is they match up lenders with loans and they walk away. So there have been instances where these brokers, who are lightly regulated and in some states hardly at all, there have been instances where these brokers lie to both sides. Either they change the income and financial information of the borrower, or they tell people that they're getting one type of loan when it really turns out to be a different type of loan, or they fail to tell them that there are prepayment penalties and all kinds of other things that make the loan a little bit more attractive to lenders. That and the lenders have just been, the people giving the money have been a little bit too aggressive in thinking they're going to get their money back.
We're going to hold it here for now. Check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then more calls from you. We now have a couple of open lines for your questions about the subprime mortgage meltdown, the causes and cures and effects. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our conversation prompted in part by the Democratic presidential candidates getting in on the act and offering their solutions to the crisis, including Senator Clinton's $1 billion bailout idea. More after the news. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 7:36 now on this Tuesday, August the 14th. We're talking about the subprime mortgage crisis or situation, and what it's doing to the stock market, the economy, to foreclosure rates and what the Democratic presidential candidates are proposing to do to fix it and how the administration is reacting to that. And our guest economist is answering your questions. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Kevin Quinn, our guest, associate professor of economics at St. Norbert College in De Pere. And before we go back to the phones, Professor Quinn, can you kind of bring us up to date on where things stand right now? I know I was on vacation last week, but I was watching the news and the stock market was going wild again, and then the Fed Reserve stepped in, and I think now things have calmed down a little bit.
Yes, I think some people, let me start with this. I don't think that the increase in foreclosure rates shocked people who were really paying attention to this. I mean, this was brewing up for quite a while, and as I was doing a little background reading for this, I found quite a bit in that was written, in 04, 05, early 06, that sort of suggested this could happen. So that's not the part that really shook people up. I think the thing that scared the markets was how widespread and how opaque the risk that was being borne was. There were some very large investment funds that went under, basically, as a result of this, because they had way too much of this risk. They were way too exposed to it, and the investors were unaware of that. And this called into question, how widespread is this? How bad is this? And, with every little piece of news, good or bad, the market would react one way or the other. And I think that that's largely among the markets, barring any other shock, people are a little less worried about that than they were before. I think they're aware of the fact that the central banks are going to not permit a meltdown, and so people have all taken a deep breath.
Mm-hmm. Jerry in Genesee Depot, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. My idea of the subprime market is that it's like the stock market. You make an investment in something. Sometimes you win and sometimes you lose, but if you're in the stock market, they don't bail you out if you have a bad buy. Many of these people won't be different than they were before. They didn't put any money into the project, and when they leave without any, they're back to square one. They had a chance, but things failed, and the market dictates who makes it.
Professor Quinn?
I think that's true to some extent. The extent to which people knew the risks that they were undertaking. A lot of your listeners have 401ks or pension funds, et cetera. Those funds that invested in these products may or may not have been aware of the risk that the subprime mortgages, what they represented. The other thing is that people who got foreclosed upon, typically you just don't walk away from your house. You liquidate everything you possibly can. And so people who have been trying to hang on to their houses have, they have nothing left by the time they're done with this. So I agree with you that people have to read the documents that they're signing. People have to be aware of the fact that when they invest in something that it could go the other way. And I think there's going to be more of that. But, the extent to which there were predatory practices or just outright lying, I think that's yet to be seen.
Yeah, but that's what the Democratic presidential candidates are saying, that we've got to crack down on these unscrupulous brokers, or we've got to increase penalties for predatory lending.
There's no question that those practices were going on. Absolutely none. Just as in the late 1990s, there's no question that there were all kinds of financial shenanigans going on in tech markets and energy markets. However, the tech meltdown was a bigger problem than people just cheating. It was a lot of rose-colored glasses, and I think the same thing to some extent applies here. Clearly, the low-hanging fruit in any policy is to figure out, what kinds of practices were actually already illegal, and what kinds of practices perhaps should be illegal, and put a stop to those.
Yeah. Thanks, Jerry, for the call. Stacy in Junction City is with us now. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to let you know what happened to my husband and I about 4 years ago. We had gotten a loan through a mortgage broker. Unfortunately, in the 30 pages of documents that we did sign, that I guess we should have had a lawyer go through and look at, my husband got laid off. We fell a half a month behind, paid it the next month, and it's stipulated in our contract somewhere that they could double our payments.
Mm.
So they doubled our payments. We continued paying for 3 months, and they never told us. So 3 months later, we're $2,000 behind, and we're in, you know, looking at foreclosure. And as far as being a responsible person for the loan, we did not go over our limits. We stayed within what we knew we could afford, and we just feel that we were bamboozled, and it was a terrible situation. And now, for the next 7 to 10 years, my husband and I won't be able to get a loan.
Yeah. So you were foreclosed on, Stacey?
We were. Yeah. Our lawyer wanted us to try to fight it because he said what they did was illegal. But to be honest with you, I mean, the lawyer costs and everything to do it, we couldn't do it,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
Kevin Quinn?
Yes, I'm very sorry to hear that about that situation. I think that sort of thing has happened way, way too much. There are disclosure forms. I mean, part of the reason why you have to sign, you know, 30 million different pieces of paper is because there are rules about having to disclose these things. And obviously, I don't know about this particular situation. Mm-hmm. If your attorney thinks that there was something illegal done, that may have been the case. Absolutely, I think all parties except the crooks mm-hmm. agree that there needs to be perhaps better policing of brokers, perhaps licensing, and, you know, state to state, those laws vary. Recently, the Fed just issued some new guidelines, and more states are beginning to adopt them. But that to me, seems like the first order of business is what, you know, Bush says. Enforce the laws that exist. The extent to which new laws should be passed is a different question.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Stacey, and sorry for your experience. Tom in Burlington, hi, you're on the air.
Welcome back from your vacation. I hope you got a chance to see Hairspray. Take our minds off of all these troubles we have.
I did not, but I had fun in Philadelphia.
I want to recommend it to everybody. It's one way to get your mind off troubles. I'd just like to explain. I sold real estate. When you use the word broker, you might point out there's a real estate broker and there's a mortgage broker, and that there's two different kind of brokers that some people deal with. But the problem that I see is. And we touched on this about 6 months ago on your show, and we were talking about the prices of real estate getting out of reach for the average home buyer. With the appraisers, we're appraising property, and the appraiser appraises it. Then they go to the bank with the appraisal's opinion, and these houses were not appraising out, but the appraisers would say, well, by the time you get to the bank, the price will match the appraiser. And a lot of real estate brokers will not use an appraiser that is honest and gives us the facts. You can pick any kind of appraiser you want. So on that side of the deal, the appraisers were not giving the right information. On the other side, on the bank side, the bank regulators couldn't figure out these subprime rate mortgages to save their life. So they're giving bad information on that side. So you've got this two little areas that need a little regulation. We allow the bankers to self-regulate themselves, and it's not working. You need a little bit of regulation. The Republican philosophy, and I like Republican people, but they get stuck on some kind of word, and they're not able to be a little flexible. You do need a little bit of regulation. We had that problem with Enron, where there was no regulation. So the thing is, what the Democrats are proposing is a good idea. I don't even think it's enough, because we are now in a meltdown situation where Wall Street isn't a place where you can make money, where real estate isn't a place where you can make money. So everybody's losing confidence and trust.
Yeah.
And a man, Mr. Henry Ford, who started the Industrial Revolution, he said a very interesting comment. He said, if the public knew how the banks were ripping off the public, they would shoot every one of them. I don't recommend that.
No, I don't either, Tom. And I got to jump in because we're at weather break time. Professor Quinn, a reaction to Tom's comments?
I think he's right on the nose that, you know, appraisers get paid when they appraise, and they're going to be chosen to appraise if they help the deal go through. And so there was clearly some moral hazard there. I'm not saying all appraisers were doing that, but there were some who actually didn't even know what they were doing. They just said, what number do you want? That's what you got.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of got built into the system, too, is that rosy scenario.
Kevin Quinn, our guest, Associate Professor of Economics at St. Norbert College in De Pere. We're talking about the mortgage crisis, the subprime mortgage meltdown, some are calling it, which caused lots of stock market jitters last week and is forcing a lot of families out of their homes, a lot of foreclosures going on. Talking about why this is happening and what could be done about it, a lot of the Democratic presidential candidates are proposing some cures, and we're getting our guest's take on that, and he's answering your questions as well. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
At Wisconsin Public Radio, we have a special club for thoughtful people who've taken the time to include WPR in their estate plans. It's called the Signature Circle. You might say it's a way of signing your name to support the future of the programs you value. Thanks to all Signature Circle members who are leaving a legacy of learning for future generations.
This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. 12 minutes before 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, August the 14th. Coming up after 8, I'll be talking with the author of the book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies. I think you'll be interested in that conversation coming up in our next hour. It's right now 12 minutes before 8 o'clock. We are talking with Kevin Quinn, Associate Professor of Economics at St. Norbert College in De Pere, talking about the subprime mortgage mess. And our next caller is John in Chicago. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Good morning. First of all, thank you for taking my call. I just want to say this is the first time I've been actually listening to your show, and it's very interesting. Yeah, what I wanted to say basically is I wanted to kind of give you a perspective of the other side. I'm an owner of a broker mortgage shop, and the way I do business, the way we do it basically is I look at it this way. We are limited to what we can do because all the information that we give is based on what the client gives us, and then we get in turn we give that information to the corresponding lender. Now, the lender is the one that lets us know what they want, what conditions, follow the approval, if it's going to be okay or not. And then secondly, in response to also to what you were talking a little bit about, the appraisal, we also have to order an appraisal for whatever loan we submit, but the appraisal also has to be reviewed by the actual lender. So even if someone decides to, let's say, bump up the appraisal just a little bit, it doesn't mean that it's going to go through because the lender has to review the appraisal. So the guidelines, we're limited to what their guidelines are going to allow us to do. It's our responsibility, yes, to let the client know what they can afford, if they're comfortable with certain payments, and you have to, we have a responsibility. The way I work is that it's my responsibility to let the client know exactly what they, you know, what they're going to qualify for, if they can or cannot make these payments, and what comes along with this loan. That doesn't mean, even if the loan is okay and their payment is fine, it still doesn't mean that it's going to get accepted. It doesn't mean that we're going to close because, again, we have to go through the process of being approved by the lender and satisfying all conditions and making sure that the appraisal goes through. So I just kind of wanted to let you know that side of it and see what you think and also what the outcome and what some of these changes are going to bring about and how can we fix this really big mess.
Well, thank you very much, John, for tuning in. Good day to tune in, I suppose. Professor Quinn?
Yes, I mentioned earlier that it takes two to make a baby. You need, in addition to people who are a little too optimistic about their ability to pay, you know, they fall in love with the idea of a house and they fall in love with a particular house and they sort of, you know, lose rationality there. I think that happened on the lender side, too. I mean, there are a lot of people that looked at this and realized that, boy, these loans are not going to pay off and that the spread between the conventional mortgage rate and the subprime mortgage rates is probably not large enough. But in a market where you can securitize these, as you can sort of, you know, transfer the risk all the way around, you know, the question becomes, when the music stops, who's holding the potato? It turns out a lot of people were holding the potato. That's the part that is scaring the market so much, and that's why it's going to get a little bit tougher to get these loans. It's not that people aren't going to be willing to take on these obligations. The other side of it is going to be less willing.
Yeah. And do you expect to see any big changes or implications from this this problem?
Well, I think you've already seen it. Mm-hmm. I think that you know, there's been a sobering up of the financial markets, and I think you're going to start having some
CEO is looking at their risk management mechanisms in some of these funds. In addition to that, there's no doubt that that there's going to be some sort of legislation coming out of the Congress, whether or not that's signed by the president or if that waits till the next president. It's a different story. But the Fed's already taken action. They have begun to tighten some of that up. But, you know, we have to remember that this was welcomed by Alan Greenspan, these subprime loans in the markets that went with them, as a democratization of the lending markets. I mean, it is absolutely true that these things offered the opportunity for home ownership that did not exist before. And anything that we do from the policy side is definitely going to prohibit some people from getting mortgages that may have been able to do so before. Now, maybe that's a good idea. Maybe, you know, if the policy is done right, the mortgages that have very little chance of being successful will be blocked. But, you know, policy is a messy business.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Linda in Pewaukee is with us now. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I just had a question, comment, that isn't the real problem that many people simply can't afford to buy a home, and so these kinds of things happen because people are desperate. And then my question was, are most all of these foreclosures on low-income people who have bought a modest house, or are some of them on houses that are larger and maybe higher-income people have purchased them, but they were not able to keep up the payments?
Do you know that, Professor Quinn?
I'm not an expert on this, and I have seen numbers, and I don't remember what they are, but it seems that that this is not just limited to low-income people, that people had eyes bigger than their stomachs, as it were, and some of these are in really nice neighborhoods with really nice, expensive houses. But you're right, and I've been thinking about this a little bit, and I think it has to do with the growing spread between the top of the income distribution and the bottom. You know, as Americans were assaulted with images about greater and greater consumerism, the idea that you're entitled to have all of these things, you know, to have a certain lifestyle. And, you know, we see the way that, you know, other people live, and we think that we're missing out. And in the last 10 or 15 years in particular, I think, there's been this press to go ahead and get that. And somehow we're going to be optimistic. It'll all work out somehow. I think we, as consumers, we have to be a little more realistic than we've been. And that's not just houses. That's credit cards. That's all kinds of lifestyle choices that maybe things, you know, maybe we need a little more reality about that.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Linda, for the call. John in Madison is with us now. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, last week, in response to this lending crisis, the stock market tumbled around 400 points in one day. And instead of letting the market correct itself, as the conservatives like to think can happen, the Fed stepped in, and also its European counterpart, and they respectively pumped in around $80 billion apiece. That's $160 billion. And it staunched this drop. But I don't quite understand that it just, you know, mystically improved the fate of people, that the market was not going to drop because they pumped this money so banks can make loans. I don't understand how it stopped the drop in the stock market. It obviously didn't directly affect this debacle in the mortgage market.
Yeah, I was wondering that too, Professor Quinn.
Yeah, the various swaps and overnight loans that banks have are pretty complicated, but I guess the way I would say it is this way. There's a difference between owning an asset and owning a liquid asset. And, you, for example, if you owned you know, a whole bunch of real estate, but your gas bill was due, you might be, you know, wealthy, but if you don't have any cash flow, you're in trouble. And essentially what the Fed and the other central banks were trying to do was trying to lubricate the gears a little bit, because what can happen is you can have a cascading series of defaults. And that's what happened in, you know, 1905. That's what happened in 1929. Part of the reason why the Fed exists, maybe the primary reason why the Fed exists, is to prevent those kinds of things from happening. So they pump liquidity into the system, get the thing working normally again, and, you know, allow everyone to sort of take a deep breath and look at it. This happened in 1987. You know, Greenspan was on the job not very long, and there was the market crash there. Happened in 98. There was a currency crisis in Asia, and it caused liquidity issues. By pumping money into the system, it allows the system to continue to function.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Patty in Rice Lake. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I had the understanding that ballooning payments, part of the idea of that was that the more you work, the more your wages are going to increase. And they haven't, not much, for most of us. And to think that the presidential candidates are out hollering about this is laughable, because I have read that a livable wage in this country would be between $12 and $17 an hour. And the Democrats got in, and we barely got $7 an hour. And I wanted to ask the economist, is a livable wage of $12 to $17 an hour, would that break our economy? And to what extent, you know, talk a little bit more about the idea of the ballooning payments and increased wages.
Yeah.
And I'll listen off the air.
Thank you. And we only have about a minute, Professor Quinn.
Yeah, the ballooning payments, the 228s or something like that, were based on optimism. Optimism on the part of the lenders that housing prices were going to go up and they would be protected. Optimism on the part of the borrowers that their housing value would go up and they would qualify for a better loan and their incomes would go up. Well, that didn't work out. And, you know, they bet wrong, and this is what we have now.
Yeah. We have less than a minute, but I have one more caller online who wants to know, why haven't we learned from past crises? Should we have learned something that would have prevented this?
You know, we don't learn. we don't learn. You know, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, every time you hear somebody say that, oh, no, it's different now, get scared. Occasionally they're right. Most of the time they're not. It really isn't different. It's just a groupthink that everyone sort of buys into the idea that it's different, but sooner or later, you know, the rabbit comes home.
Well, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Kevin Quinn, Associate Professor of Economics at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing the hour and to Cheryl Gasser for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Lots more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.